Donald Reel Number 4. Now, after you left Eastchurch... Now, when you left Eastchurch at the end of February, you were posted to the Naval Air Station at Eastbourne. Could you describe for me the air duties of the airplanes at Eastbourne?
Yes, we had some quite nice planes there, the old Bristol tractor with an 80 horsepower and all, which was a beautiful plane to fly, called the Bristol Balloon. She could land her so slowly she can glide, but she was a beautiful machine to fly. And Morris Farman, one or two of the old shorts from the same type as Eastchurch. And the main job was doing short, you might call escort patrols of merchant ships that were coming off, round up the channel off Beachy Head, because there was a good deal of torpedoing going on then. And they say, while I was, during a month I was working from Eastbourne, I never actually saw any torpedoing. We say this, that while any ships we were escorting never got torpedoed, so it may have helped. On the other hand, when we went there, some of them did get torpedoed, so it may not have caused an effect. But the main job was escorting merchant ships off Eastbourne. Sounds a bit dull, but it's a very pleasant place to be stationed. The only really sad thing was Arthur Shepherd, who was a great chum of Sorley, and Sorley, Rafe Sorley, but became my great chum then. And Arthur Shepherd, he got killed. He was flying one of the older Bristol box kites and taking it out over the sand dune, just heading for the sea, and one of those flat, calm days when the water's so calm you can't see it, and his engine cut. Normally he could have made a pancake landing just on the water without the slightest trouble, but he must have misjudged the height, because you simply can't see calm water when it's a slightly hazy day like that. We couldn't see him, but we got over the edge of the sand dunes. He'd obviously hit the water with his wheels turned upside down, and the plane was about half a mile offshore with the wheel sticking up in the air. So by the time we'd swum out there, he was a goner.
Could you describe for me the frequency with which the convoy patrol work at Eastbourne took place, as far as you were concerned individually, and also describe for me the normal routine on these convoy operations?
I can only say very approximately, probably each pilot would be out perhaps two or three times a week, I should think. Perhaps a little oftener, I can't be just sure of that. And the operations themselves weren't very complicated, because we didn't have any bombs or anti-submarine weapons. The idea was you simply did your normal zigzag patrol near the ship, keeping your eyes out for any submarine. If you did see a submarine approaching, flew down low over them and fired a red various light, several of that red various light, right over where he was. That let any naval ships or shore establishments know right away that there was a submarine attack pending and where the submarine was, and it wasn't very good for the submarine. Of course, as soon as the submarine twigged that he'd been spotted, he dived quickly and ceased to be dangerous. But that's really all there was to it. As far as we were concerned, it wasn't a very complex operation.
There's one thing which I don't understand. How did you locate your convoys, and who gave you your instructions about where to find them?
Oh, we just get that direct from the CO and Lieutenant Commander Shepherd. He would get them from the naval authorities on the coast or the coast guards who were advising of movements of ships. I can't say personally how they came to him. But.
And on average, how long would you stay with the convoy?
Well, our flights in those days went a long duration, one about 35, 45 or 60 mil an hour or so.
Now, when you finished this operational work at Eastbourne, you were posted to Calshot for seaplane training. How do you account for your getting seaplanes when other people who were at Eastbourne with you got Dunkirk and more active flying in on the Western Front?
You're now touching on one of the bitter moments of my life and Rafe Sawley's. We spent our month at Eastbourne doing all our very best to convince our CO that we were aerobatic pilots in a modest sort of way, and that we were definitely the lads that should get sent to Dunkirk, which was the aim of most of the younger pilots. At the end of our spell at Eastbourne, we discovered to our horror that merely because we'd been rather good at navigation, a very different idea had been building up. Navigation itself was fairly simple, but it meant working out allowance for wind drift, compass deviation, and so on, triangles of forces. And it wasn't frightfully complex, but we got quite key. We were fairly sort of things we'd done at school. And unfortunately, the Commander White, who took navigation, gave us rather a glowing report in the navigation line. And that was our doom, because we suddenly found ourselves, to our horror, posted to Calshot for seaplanes. And it was some of the other chaps that got to Dunkirk. So we went, proceeded to Calshot with our hearts in our boots.
Why was it that navigation competence meant seaplane operations and not airplane operations in France? I mean, navigation skills are of significance for landflying.
Well, the point is, they knew the seaplanes would eventually be used with the fleet and probably do some fairly long trips over the water, in which navigation does enter into it quite a bit. Whereas the chaps at Dunkirk, all they needed to look at was to look at the line of smoke and muck, and that was the front line. You're either on this side or on the other side, or stop your engine for a few minutes and listen to the noise. You knew damn well where you were. You didn't need to do much navigation.
Before we leave Eastbourne, could you just describe it for me as a station? I mean, what it was like physically, the layout of it, and what, you know, day-to-day life was like on the station.
Going too far back.
Okay.
I can remember the planes and the chaps very well, but I don't remember much. Rather usual canvas sheds and quite a nice little airfield, but that's all I can say about it.
What about Calshot? Do you have any picture of Calshot in your mind?
Oh, very much, yes. It was a very prominent naval air station. It had been built as a naval air station with concrete slipways and permanent sheds. And a splendid chap, the CO, Travers. Generally known as Travers, because he's a terrific stutterer. He was an absolutely super fellow, lieutenant commander. He was an uncle, I think, of Ben Travers, the writer of all the Aldwych farces that used to be very well known in London theatre. But C.O. Travers was an absolutely toughing fellow. And he was wonderful stationed at Calshot. That was a mixture of seaplane instruction, submarine patrols, and God knows what.
Can we start off talking about Calshot by you describing for me what you found what you as a pilot found the essential differences to be between airplane flying and seaplane flying?
Well, to begin with, I can only say the seaplanes felt simply appalling. The first problem was to get the things unstuck off the water. I mean, the short spans and the dear old Bristol balloon, you take them off I could take a Bristol balloon off in 35 yards comfortably. Sometimes you're dashed lucky if you got a seaplane off in 3 miles, and that's not an exaggeration. If the water was a bit calm, and it was one of the rather inefficient ones with very small speed range and not well designed floats, you could go up half the length of the Solent before you got off. And even then, when you got off, the climb was appalling. The speed range was like being back to the old Wright again. Poor old Morris, the first machine I flew, the poor old Morris Farman, had about the same speed range, about 42 miles an hour, knots flat out, about 39 knots stall. You took off at Calshot. You got to the top of Southampton Water. You're damn lucky if you'd enough height to turn, because you always lost height in a turn like that. And you had to turn, because otherwise you'd have been inland. It's not advisable to go far inland on the seaplane. And coax her around in a turn and come back down the loch again. Sorry, actually, it's not a loch, Southampton Water, but it's what we call a loch. And coax her back to get a bit more height again. It really was rather appalling. The next thing that you suddenly realise, the first time you land a seaplane, I'm quite certain I'm not the first person that said it, you don't realise water is hard. Even when you do a belly flop driving dive, you think it's hard, but wait till you hit it on a seaplane. The very first time I landed in a seaplane, I just said to myself, and I'm quite certain hundreds of other pilots have said, my God, I've overshot the beats, I've landed on concrete. That's exactly what I said. I thought I'd overshot the water, it's so hard. It really is a shock to you the first time you land on small waves to find out how hard they are, even at 40 knots. But after we got clear of the old Morris, which, poor old thing, she did her best, but she was a pretty hopeless thing. And the next thing was a white seaplane built by the Samuel White at Cowes, I think, but with some marvellous patent double-stepped floats. Magnificent floats they were, but the rest of the machine was pretty terrible. All she could do to drag the floats into the air, then one was a pusher. I remember she made such a devil of a fuss taking off once.
This is the white that was
the
a
white,
pusher.
Yes, the white. One was a pusher, the other was a tractor, and one was about as bad as the other. I remember the pusher distinguishes the one way she took. After taking about a mile to take off, lucky for me, she hadn't taken off very high, because the propeller bust and cut the tailbooms off, so she promptly landed herself on her floats, fortunately.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
The propeller bust. Uh-huh. Cut the tailbooms off. She landed basically on her floats again, which is lucky for me. She'd only done it from a height of about 6 or 8 feet. It would be damned unfortunate if she'd done it a wee bit higher up. But and the big tractor was just as big a brute to fly. Then the shorts we came along. They, with the Canton Unay engines, they were a nice seaplane, as a seaplane. And with the 225 Sunbeams, I didn't get a chance. They were only one or two. I didn't get a chance to try them. And it was a very nice sop with... Well, she was almost like a land plane to fly once you took a fair run to get off. And I only got flying once, the little Snyder Cup sop with. They were a dream, just like land planes when you really took them off. They did about 100 miles an hour. They were real little fighters with floats on, but they looked on as being a bit dangerous for any practical use.
Apart from this Sopwith, which, as you say, was rather exceptional as seaplanes go, the other seaplanes, you've described the problems associated with takeoff and landing. What about their general handling characteristics when they were in the air? How would you compare those with...
Oh, it was like stepping from a very super sports car into a double-decker bus. That was about the comparison of handling. As far as I was concerned, for anybody reasonably light-handed, a seaplane was really pretty terrible.
To what extent was your transition from airplanes to seaplanes accompanied by formal instruction?
Well, to be perfectly honest, you couldn't say there was such a thing as formal instruction at all. It was more or less like the area patrols and things like that. You just were feeling your way by trial and error. It was a good deal of trial and as little error as you could manage. There were always one or two senior people, like the first lieutenant, who perhaps come up with you on your first flight, as if he'd come as a passenger, to make sure you could land the thing on the water. And watch you flying from the shore, your first flight or two, and see if you're made howling blunders and mention it to you. But after that, it was more or less a case of rather like when you're young being chucked into the deep end and knowing you've damn well got to swim. We just trained ourselves on the kind of basis of mutual self-help. It was a very good way.
I suppose it might be fair to make a comparison with having learnt to fly on, having learnt to drive on a Rolls-Royce, suddenly being given a tractor. That might be comparable to the kind of differences that existed between airplanes and seaplanes.
Oh, it was more acutely even than that. I would say it was like stepping from a super sports car into a double-decker bus, or did I tell you that before?
Yeah.